he said.
Yeah, you did, Kirk.
Well, let's see. An hour ago, I was with Gerald Lee.
I heard a woman's voice, Kirk.
You didn't let me finish.
So finish.
I was with Gerald and his fiancée. Did I tell you he got engaged?
No, I said, thinking it had been years since I'd even heard him mention Gerald, making his old college friend a very convenient alibi. You sure didn't.
Yeah, so anyway, we had a quick bite.
I thought you had a migraine.
I did. Still do, but I had to eat. And now I'm headed to bed.
His voice was suddenly both hushed and hurried. I'm so sorry you're not feeling well, I said as insincerely as I could.
That's okay, I'll be fine, he said. Everything okay there?
Sure, I said, pausing, listening to the conspicuous silence in his background. I pictured him huddled in a marble hotel bathroom, someone waiting for him in the next room. Maybe she was even beside him in bed, craning to hear my every word so they could analyze it together.
Okay, well, I'll see you tomorrow, he said.
Yeah, I said, then made myself say the last three words I wanted to say to him. I love you. It didn't feel like the truth at that second, more like a test, as I waited to see what he'd say in return.
You too, he simply said back,
failing with flying colors. A few seconds later, my phone rang again. I expected it to be Kirk, attempting to apologize for his abruptness, fix things, talk to me. But it was Tom. Surprised, I answered hello. He said hello back, sounding tentative as he went on to thank me for coming over this morning. I told him of course, then thanked him for allowing us to come. After an awkward pause, he told me a disturbing story about him overhearing a conversation between two women I apparently knew. Something about Lila and Finch and the incident. But it was a comfort to hear from him, and a welcome interruption in an intense period of panic and loneliness. Bolstered by the brief exchange, I went into Kirk's office, determination replacing sadness. I sat in his desk chair, swiveling to the left and right, staring at the neat piles of papers, his pewter pencil cup filled with only black Pilot rollerball pens. I opened his drawers, one at a time, three down the left, three down the right, and one long, skinny one in the middle. I don't know what I was looking for, but I methodically combed through everything. I found nothing suspicious, but ascribed the lack of evidence to his fastidiousness, not his innocence. I turned on his laptop. I didn't expect to find anything there either, as he knew that I knew his password. But I still scrutinized his email inbox, just in case, scanning rows of names and boring subject lines. Just as I was about to give up, I saw an email dated today from Bob Tate, Kirk's ticket broker. I clicked and read the thread, a complicated back and forth among Bob, Kirk, and Finch, and pieced together a very different story than the one Finch had given me earlier. In a nutshell, Finch wanted four tickets to the show, not two, for the express purpose of making amends with Lila Volpe. He didn't think she'd go if it were just the two of them. Kirk summarized the request to Bob, who came through in grand style, explaining that the price was steep because they were limited admission and last minute. Kirk said no problem, and he'd settle up in cash when back in town. Son of a bitch, I said aloud, the magnitude of their betrayal sinking in. My son and husband had essentially conspired against me. It occurred to me that I had done the same thing this morning. I had brought my son to the Volpe home unbeknownst to my husband. I had encouraged Finch to lie to his father, at least by omission. But I believed in my heart that there was a vital difference. I had been trying to do what was right and show my son how important that was. Kirk was, as always, simply trying to manipulate others in his quest to get his way. There was really no way around it. My husband, whom I'd once thought of as charming and take charge, was simply a user and a liar. And the worst part of it all was that he was teaching our son to be those very things. I'd always pictured marriages severing more dramatically, with an explosive fight or irrefutable proof, stronger than a pocket dial, of an affair. But in that quiet moment in Kirk's office, waiting for our son to return from a concert with a girl he had mistreated and maybe even manipulated, I felt in my bones that my marriage was over. I wanted a divorce. I was done. So done. I woke up the next morning to a disjointed dream about Tom and suddenly remembered his call the night before. It almost seemed like a dream, too, coming as it had during so much turmoil. I found my phone on my nightstand and started a text to Tom, confessing that I'd had something of a rough night and apologizing if I'd acted a bit off. I reread my words, then deleted them, the statement sounding a little inappropriate. Inappropriate. I repeated the word in my head, realizing how much I despised it. It was a favorite of Kathy and all her Bible buddies, the catch-all for any behavior they wished to judge. Her dress was inappropriate for a wedding. That book selection was inappropriate for teenagers. The conversation they were having in front of children was inappropriate. Her political post was inappropriate. A text to a single attractive father asking about a drunken conversation? So, very inappropriate. Screw being appropriate, I thought, as I dialed Tom's number, hoping he would answer. He did, almost immediately. Hi, it's Nina, I said, my palms turning clammy. Hi, he said. Did I wake you? I asked. No, he said. I've been up for a while. Oh, I said. Are you all right? He asked. Yeah, I was just thinking about our call last night and your Uber ride. I should have kept my mouth shut with those women, but you didn't, I said, feeling a surge of respect for him. Correct, he said, with a hint of a laugh. What did you say to them exactly? Just the facts. That I was her father, and that she wasn't Mexican. He started to say something else, but then stopped. What? Nothing. You were going to say something. Yeah, he said. I was. What was it? Please tell me. It was about your husband. What about him? I asked, both dreading his response and praying that he'd give me more evidence, say something bad about the man I wanted to leave. I probably shouldn't get into that. It's really none of my business, Tom said. And it could complicate our situation. Our situation? I repeated, wondering if he meant our two kids and the hearing on Tuesday, or the unlikely connection we seem to be forging. You know, everything else that's going on, he replied vaguely. Yeah, I said, my head pounding from the swirling subtext. We sat in silence for another few seconds before he cleared his throat and said, Look, those women were drunk, really drunk. Who knows if anything they said was true? And I could have heard them wrong. I was driving. I closed my eyes. Let me guess. They were talking about Kirk cheating on me, I said. Yes, he said softly but swiftly. They were. I'm sorry. It's fine. You're not telling me anything I don't already know, I said. It was an overstatement. I didn't know anything for sure, but I didn't want Tom to feel guilty. I could hear him draw a deep breath, then say my name on a weary exhale. It sounded like a plea. Yes, I said in response. I don't know you very well, he said slowly, as if very carefully choosing his words. But you deserve better than this. I know, I managed to reply. Thank you, Tom. Right after we said goodbye and hung up, I realized that I'd forgotten to mention Lila and Finch and my strong suspicion that they had gone out the night before.
I told myself I needed to call him back. But I couldn't make myself do it. I was just too disappointed in Finch, in my life. Instead, I called my best friend and told her I needed to see her, that I was having a crisis. She asked no questions, simply saying she'd be home all day, waiting for me. I then went to check on Finch. I'd heard him come in the night before, around midnight. I went upstairs now, lightly knocking on his door. When he didn't answer, I opened it. He was sound asleep and lightly snoring, the covers tucked up under his chin. I walked over to his bedside and put my hand on his shoulder, shaking him gently, then harder, until his eyes opened and his mouth closed. "Yeah, Mom," he said, squinting groggily up at me. "Hi. I just wanted to let you know I'm headed home, to Bristol. I'll be back sometime tomorrow, but Dad will be here in a few hours. Is everything okay with Nana and Gramps?" he asked. "Yes," I said, comforted that he'd shown himself capable of concern. "I just feel like I need to go home."
"Okay,"
he said, blinking. "Do you want to come with me?" I asked. Knowing he would not, his lack of interest in his grandparents these days made me sad. But right now, it was obviously low on the list of things to be sad about.
"I have a lot of homework," he replied,
his eyelids fluttering and closing again. I stared at his face for a few seconds before reaching out to lightly shake his arm.
"Yeah, Mom,"
he said, his eyes still closed. "How was the concert?" I asked.
"Fine," he said. "Fun."
"Good. I'm glad. It was so nice that Beau could get those tickets," I said.
"Uh-huh."
"And it was just the two of you? Or did you go with other people?"
"Just the two of us."
"Okay. Well, remember your father's coming home today," I said, feeling sick on so many levels. It was the way divorced people talked. "Your father," rather than "Dad."
"Yeah. You already said that, Mom."
"Does he know you went to the concert?" I asked, giving him one final chance.
"Nope,"
he said, finally opening his eyes so he could lie right to my face.
"I haven't talked to him."
Strike three, I thought, walking out of his room. I arrived in downtown Bristol shortly after 2 o'clock, going first to Julie's house, a small cottage that she and Adam had lived in forever. As I got out of my car, I spotted her on one of 2 rocking chairs on the wraparound front porch they'd recently painted. I'd selected the color for her, Benjamin Moore tranquil blue. "Hey there," I called out with a little wave. "I love your porch. It looks so pretty." She waved back at me, still rocking in her chair. "Thanks to you." I climbed the porch stairs as she stood and held out her arms, then pulled me into a long, tight hug. It was comforting, as was the familiar scent she'd been wearing since high school, Chanel No. 5, which she'd once joked was the only Chanel she'd ever own. "Have you lost weight? You feel tiny," I asked, backing up to look at her. Other than brisk walks and swims at the Y, Julie never worked out, and she was built like a delicate bird. Sort of the opposite of her personality. Tinier than usual, I should say.
"I don't think so," she said,
pulling at the waistband of her khaki shorts and glancing down to check the space between the fabric and her stomach.
"I don't have a scale, so I'm not really sure."
"You don't have a scale?" I said, thinking I weighed myself at least twice a day, mostly out of mindless habit, but also due to general vigilance. My being thin was so important to Kirk. And so it had become that way to me, too.
"Nope. Not since I caught the girls weighing themselves," she said as we each took a rocking chair. "I didn't think much about it until Reese declared herself the winner because she was a pound lighter than Paige."
She shook her head as she snapped her fingers, making a crisp sound.
"I nipped that in the bud."
"God, you're so good about that stuff," I said.
wondering if it was ever tough for Paige, who had inherited more of Adam's stocky build. Reese looked just like her mother. I was ashamed of having the thought and saw it as another sign that I'd been focusing on the wrong things. I felt sure it wasn't something Julie had ever worried about. Her lack of shallowness, coupled with feelings of self-acceptance, transferred to everyone close to her, most of all her daughters. It's a good thing I had a boy. I'd have screwed up a girl even worse. No, you wouldn't have, she said, but conspicuously did not deny that I'd screwed up Finch. I told myself this wasn't the time to get defensive. I needed to have a thick skin. After all, if I'd wanted someone to help me take the easy way out, I would have called Melanie. Anyway, I said.
Yes, anyway.
Would you like some lunch? I made some chicken salad. No, thanks, I said. I'm not really hungry right now.
Something to drink? Coffee? Sweet tea? A glass of rosé?
Although I actually could have used some caffeine, I didn't want to interrupt the moment. I wanted us to stay exactly where we were for as long as possible. No, thanks, I said. Where are Adam and the girls?
They're running errands. I gave them a very long list.
I smiled and thanked her, knowing she'd done this for my sake, probably changing her own plans for the day, too.
Of course, no problem, she said. So tell me, what's going on? I assume this is about Finch?
Yes and no, I said, then caught her up on everything. Our visit to Tom and Lila, Finch's apology, the tickets to see Luke Bryan, Finch's lies, Kirk's lies, all of them. Bastard, Julie said under her breath. I knew it. As she started to get all worked up, I raised my hand and stopped her. Yeah, but honestly, that's the least of it, I said. It's more the kind of husband and father he is, the person he's become. It's everything. I think the affair is just a symptom of it all, and I just can't do it anymore.
Meaning? She said softly.
Meaning? I think I want a divorce, I said. Julie didn't miss a beat. It was almost as if she'd been waiting for this.
Okay, she said. Let's back up. Did you find something, texts or receipts?
No, just the pocket dial and what Tom told me he overheard, I said. I know it's circumstantial, but it's just a feeling I have, a very strong gut feeling.
And there's a lot to that, she said, but I still think you need a PI. I know a guy in Nashville. He's incredible.
I shook my head. I don't need proof. I know what he's doing.
Yes, but we still should have it. Tennessee's a fault-based state.
Which means?
Which means adultery is a factor in alimony. It's also leverage. Kirk cares so much about how things look to people.
No, he doesn't, I said, shaking my head.
Well, he cares about how things look to some people. That's why he does his philanthropy bullshit.
Maybe, I said. But those people give him a pass no matter what, because of his money. They love him for his money.
I know, she said. It's disgusting.
We rocked in silence for several seconds, both of us looking out over her front lawn, which consisted of a small square patch of grass, a beautiful magnolia, and a row of white hydrangea bushes planted along the front of the porch. The landscape was so simple it reminded me of a child's drawing, right down to the yellow butterfly fluttering on a flower near us. I could tell Julie was watching it, too, both of us tracing its flight, in and out of the dappled sunlight.
So you'll be my lawyer? I said. Julie sighed. I don't know, Nina.
What do you mean you don't know? You're my best friend, and you're a Tennessee divorce lawyer. I let out a dry laugh.
I know. And I'm happy to take your case, she said,
as I noted her telling use of the word happy in this context.
And I certainly can handle it. But you may want to consider some bigger hitters.
Bigger hitters, I said. Come on, Jules, nobody hits harder than you.
True, she said, smiling back at me.
but you know what I mean. There are lawyers who specialize in high net worth and celebrity clients.
I shook my head and said, no, I want you.
Okay, then. You have me.
Always. I nodded and said, so what's next?
We get the PI, and you gather all the information you can. Any financial information, bank statements, investments, a list of all your assets. We'll eventually subpoena records. But get everything you can for now. Once we get our ducks in a row, we will file a complaint. That's followed by a mandatory 60-day cooling-off period. From there, we do discovery.
My stomach lurched. So you think this will go to trial?
Maybe. Probably.
But don't a lot of people settle or do mediation?
Yes, she said. But honestly, I don't see mediation working with Kirk. Do you? He doesn't know the word compromise.
Yeah. He's going to be so shocked.
Oh, will the poor thing feel betrayed? She said, her voice dripping with disdain.
You really hate him, don't you? She stared at me for a beat, as if trying to restrain herself, for the sake not of her new client, but of her old friend. Yet she couldn't help herself.
Yeah, she said. I hate him, Nina.
Since when? I asked, thinking back to when Kirk had sold his company, feeling sure she would cite that as a turning point.
Since the night I met him, when he cheated in putt-putt.
Looking up at the sky, at least as much of it as I could see from the porch, I rewound to the first time I'd brought Kirk to my hometown from Vandy. I actually had a photograph from that night, which was unusual, because it was pre-camera phones. In it, Kirk, Julie, Adam, and I were all standing in the run-down parking lot of the Putt-Putt Fun Center on Bluff City Highway. The three of us from Bristol were wearing sneakers and T-shirts. But Kirk had on a polo shirt, khakis, and driving moccasins, which at the time I just thought of as loafers with funny rubber things on the bottom.
What did he do exactly?
I said, picturing him nudging the ball with his foot or taking an extra turn. The joking, impatient ways a lot of people cheated in mini golf.
He was keeping the scorecard, of course, she said, and Adam kept busting him shaving off his own strokes. Blatant cheating.
Wow. What else? I said.
What do you mean, what else, other than the cheating?
She raised her eyebrows.
Isn't that sort of like saying other than his shitty character?
I meant what else do you remember, I said, feeling the tiniest bit defensive. Not of Kirk, per se, but of the whole notion that his actions that night automatically translated to irredeemable character flaws. Other than the minutiae around mini-golf.
Mini-golf, she said with stone seriousness, is a metaphor for life.
I smiled and said, oh, really?
Yes. I mean, think about it. Do you take it seriously? Too seriously? Do you enjoy it? Do you keep careful score? Do you get upset when you lose? Do you cheat? And if you do cheat, how do you react when you're busted? Are you sheepish? Sorry. Do you do it again?
I held up my palms and said, okay, okay. All I'm saying is, I think cheating on your wife is a little worse than cheating at putt-putt. And I don't think Kirk was that bad back then, I said. After all, I fell in love with him, right?
Did you? She asked,
looking more than a little skeptical.
Yeah. I married him, Julie, I said,
hearing how lame my comeback sounded, given everything that was happening in our lives. She heard it, too, raising her eyebrows as I continued. I don't regret our whole marriage. That would be akin to regretting Finch. I just regret the past few years. Since Kirk sold his business. I think that's when he changed, I said, stopping short of mentioning money directly.
Julie nodded and said, yeah, well, he definitely got worse after that. More arrogant, more entitled. What's the saying? Money makes you more of what you already are.
Yeah, I nodded. Something like that.
Julie looked thoughtful for a beat,
as if trying to figure something out, then said,
"You know, in the past decade, I don't think I've ever been around Kirk for longer than 30 minutes in which he didn't excuse himself to go make a call."
She imitated his deep voice, then muttered, "Self-important prick." I winced at her words, knowing she was right, thinking of how he couldn't bear to be separated from his phone. In fact, the only time I'd seen him without it for any length of time was at the Masters every year, where cell phones were absolutely forbidden, no matter how wealthy or powerful you were. It was one of the few rules he actually respected, perhaps unsurprisingly, given the elitist context.
"Like, nobody's that important. Herman Frankel doesn't do that, and he's a freaking brain surgeon," Julie continued, referring to the valedictorian of our class, with whom Julie was still friends. "He never mentions his work unless other people bring it up, and he won't even make plans to go out if he's on call, because he doesn't want to have to insult people by stepping away from the table." She was on a roll now. Part of me was embarrassed for my husband, and myself for putting up with his behavior for so long, but I also felt oddly comforted by her rant. It was almost like therapy or validation.
"He's such an insufferable snob," she continued. "I mean, Nina, forget what he can afford, because I get that. If you can pay for nice hotels and first class, fine. Get your nice hotels and first class. I'd do it, too, if I could. I don't begrudge Kirk all the perks that come with wealth and success. But he thinks of himself as a higher class of person. Like he, along with his rich, white, male friends, is truly better than the rest of us."
"I know," I murmured, thinking of all the offhanded, disparaging remarks he'd made about average, hardworking Americans. The kinds of people you might see at a professional sporting event or an amusement park or the zoo.
"The public," he called them,
and that was the nicer of the terms. I'd also heard him use riffraff, dregs, proles, and plebs. He usually pretended to be joking, but the sentiment was real. That was how he felt. If something was accessible or populated by those people, he wanted no part of it. Even Disney World, I thought, reminding Julie how much I had wanted to take Finch when he was little, and how Kirk had refused to go until he learned about the VIP tour guides that movie stars used, how you could access everything from the backs of the rides, circumvent all lines, avoid the commoners. Yet he still managed to squeeze in remarks about all the fat people with their turkey legs who were riding in scooters because they were too lazy to walk. And the worst part was that he would sometimes make such comments within earshot of Finch. I shushed him, of course, or came right out and told him that wasn't nice. But I still worried that some of those ideas would rub off on our son. Julie listened, her lips pursed, then chimed in with more. "And he only pays attention to people who have a lot of money. Otherwise he sees right through you, doesn't give you the time of day. Do you know he has never once asked me about my work? And I'm an attorney. So forget Adam's job. It's as if fighting fires is, I don't know." She threw up her hands at a rare loss for words.
"Is equivalent to being in jail?" I said.
"Exactly," she said. "Although that might depend on what kind of jail. In his eyes, a white-collar criminal in a cushy federal prison probably has more status than a firefighter."
I nodded, thinking of how Kirk still defended Bob Heller, a neighbor of ours who had been sent to prison for running an elaborate Ponzi scheme. And it wasn't because Kirk believed in mercy, redemption, or forgiveness. That would have been admirable. But because he insisted his friend was a good guy who got a raw deal and hadn't ripped anyone off that much.
"So Adam hates Kirk, too?" I said, wondering how much they discussed us.
Julie shrugged. "I wouldn't say hate. Adam doesn't care enough to hate him. And honestly, I wouldn't either, except for the fact that he's married to my best friend.
I hate him for you. And for Finch." And there it was. The point of no return. My realization that if I didn't divorce Kirk for me, I had to do it for my son. Staying in the marriage any longer was giving tacit approval to everything Kirk had done. Finch needed to know that there were repercussions to his father's entitled mindset and selfish behavior. I had to make him see that there was another way to be. Tears stung my eyes, and I tried to blink them back, telling myself I had to be strong. But I couldn't. I expected Julie to glance away, as most people do when you start to cry, no matter how close they are to you. But Julie didn't look away. Instead, she fiercely held my gaze in my hand, telling me it was time, high fucking time, and that Kirk wouldn't be ignoring her anymore.
Chapter 18. Lila. I thought kissing Finch was a distinct possibility when he invited me over, especially after he made it a point to say that his parents wouldn't be home. But I didn't think we'd do anything more than that. Backing up, I should say that I'm not a virgin, but I'm also not a slut. I've only had sex with one guy. His name was, still is, Caleb King. We vaguely knew each other from middle school, where he'd been a grade ahead of me. But then he went on to Stratford, the public high school near us, and I went to Windsor the following year. So he never really crossed my mind again until last spring, when we ran into each other at the Gulch, shopping at Urban Outfitters. I didn't notice him at first. I get really focused when I'm shopping. But then he tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, didn't you go to Dalewood?" I put down the t-shirt I'd been considering and said, "Yeah, hi. It's Caleb, right?" "Yeah, that's right," he said, smiling at me. "And you're... Layla?" I smiled back at him. "Close. Lila." He asked me where I went to school, and after we covered those basics and a few others, he told me I had beautiful eyes. A few minutes of flirting later, he asked if I wanted to hang sometime. I was more flattered than psyched by the idea, but I still said yes, then gave him my number before he left the store. It was all good until Grace, who had been standing impatiently nearby, started dissing Caleb, saying he was annoying and came on too strong. Maybe he had been a little aggressive, but I somehow got the feeling that she had a bigger problem with the fact that Caleb was, still is, black. It surprised me, because I'd never thought of Grace as being at all racist, and she certainly had never said anything negative about our friend Hattie, who is white, dating Logan, who is black. I'd once even heard her say something about how cute their babies would be, so I gave her the benefit of the doubt, until she threw out the word ghetto, that is. "Ghetto?" I said. "Caleb lives in my neighborhood." "I don't mean where he lives," she said, ignoring the actual definition of the word. "I mean his whole look." "What about his look?" I said, then reminded her that we were all shopping in the same clothing store. "He was wearing a gold chain." "I think some guys can pull off a chain," I said, even though I didn't love jewelry on guys either. "Maybe if you're like Brad Pitt or Robert Pattinson." "You mean white?" I asked, which was as close as I came to calling her out. I waited for her to get defensive, but either my question was too subtle for her, or she just didn't mind the implication, because she slept the comment off with a shrug. "Okay, maybe the chain's okay, but nobody can pull off those saggy jeans," she said, making her way to the cash register with about 7 items, none of which were on sale. "His jeans weren't sagging," I said, empty-handed and super annoyed. "They were just loose-fitting." "What's the diff?" "The diff is his jeans weren't falling down," I said, thinking that I distinctly remembered watching Caleb walk away from us. I know for a fact his boxers weren't showing. At all. Grace shrugged. "Still, I just think you could do better. Way better," she said, then went on this whole tirade about how I needed to aim high in life. And wasn't that why I was at Windsor in the first place? I knew she just wanted the best for me, And maybe there really was something legit about Caleb that she didn't like but couldn't put her finger on. But I still felt like she was being really rude to him and condescending to me, and I couldn't help feeling offended. It wasn't the first time she'd made me feel like her little pet project, the poor girl she had taken under her wing. Not just because she liked me, but because she felt I needed help. Her help. As a rich white girl from the heart of Belmead. I almost told her that my dad hadn't sent me to Windsor to change up my dating pool. I was there for an education, period. But I figured it wasn't worth dissecting all of that. I was grateful to have Grace, and I didn't want to jeopardize our friendship by playing the race card or making a big deal out of something so little. Nobody was perfect, after all. Still, when Caleb and I started hanging out that summer, I didn't really fill Grace in on many specifics, just played it off as us being friends. I might not have told her anything at all, but I wanted the satisfaction of informing her that the pendant Caleb wore on a chain around his neck had belonged to his grandmother before she died. Incidentally, I also kept Caleb a secret from my dad, knowing he'd freak out about any guy, especially an older one, and figuring there was no point in worrying him. So I'd wait until he left for work, or pretend to have a babysitting gig, then ride my bike the 2 miles over to Caleb's house. His mother worked too, but unlike with my dad, there was never a possibility of her returning home during the day, since she had a 9-to-5 receptionist job. Anyway, Caleb and I had fun hanging out together, and he turned out to be more nerdy, in a quirky good way, than ghetto, which he wasn't at all. We spent a lot of time watching funny YouTube videos and playing board games. And of course we hooked up a lot too, sex seeming more inevitable with every passing day, until I finally told him I wanted to do it. It certainly wasn't the most romantic thing I'd ever pictured, as there was never any mention of love or even dating. But it still felt right enough. All the important boxes being checked. For one, I trusted Caleb in terms of STDs and stuff. He'd been with 2 girls before me, but both had been virgins. Second, I trusted him not to blab my business, although our friends didn't overlap anyway. And third, I'd just turned 16, which felt like the right age to lose my virginity. 15 had seemed too young. My final concern was the biggest. Getting pregnant. Caleb said he could use condoms, although he didn't like them because he couldn't feel as much. I wasn't too concerned about maximizing his pleasure, but I'd heard plenty of stories about condoms tearing. So I decided to get on the pill. I then called the only person I could think of who would be able to help me, but who also wouldn't judge. My mother. A few days later, she'd surprised me by sailing into town on a 24-hour birth control mission, taking me to an appointment she'd scheduled herself at Planned Parenthood. I was very grateful, as I knew how expensive her airline ticket from L.A. was. She mentioned it at least 3 times. At the same time, it was a little bit strange that she chose this, over all the other things in my life, to be proactive about. She was downright giddy about what she called my rite of passage, yet oddly never once asked anything about Caleb. It was as if he was totally beside the point. Maybe she was just that sexually liberated. Or maybe she was simply trying to make up for a lot of lost years and missed benchmarks. Or maybe she liked the idea of getting one over on Dad. That thought made me feel guilty. Regardless, I told myself it wasn't about my mother or my father. It was about my decision to have sex. And what mattered was that I was handling that decision responsibly. So after my being on the pill for the requisite 7 days, Caleb and I had sex on his twin bed in the middle of the day. It hurt. A lot. And the whole bleeding thing was totally embarrassing and disgusting. But Caleb was really cool and nice about everything. He was very patient and went really slow and kept reassuring me that there was nothing gross about blood. Adding that his mother wouldn't see the sheets because he did his own laundry. So even though I wound up thinking the whole sex thing was pretty overhyped, I still considered my first time a success in that I felt no regret and was glad I'd picked Caleb. Over the next month, we ended up having sex 11 more times, and toward the end, I actually thought I might be falling for him. But then we went back to school, and we both got really busy, and we talked less and less, until Caleb started straight ghosting me. I was a little hurt, but it was more my pride than my heart, especially when I discovered through standard social media stalking that he had gotten a legit girlfriend. I got over it pretty fast, though, my crush on Finch kicking into high gear. And now, as I got in Finch's car the morning after the concert, my feelings were becoming really intense. Like, way more than I'd ever felt for Caleb, even after we'd had sex a dozen times. If anything, I think our fight last night had made me feel more for Finch. "Hi," I said, a little out of breath from frantically trying to get ready and out the door before my dad came back from wherever he'd gone. "We meet again." It was a lame thing to say, but Finch smiled and said, "Yep, we meet again." I glanced up the street, then behind us in the opposite direction.
"You okay?" Finch said.
"Yeah, just go," I said with a nervous laugh, motioning for him to drive. I told my dad I was studying with Grace.
"Got it," Finch said, pulling away from the curb.
I did a quick scan of his outfit. A pair of gray Windsor sweats, a t-shirt with a sailboat logo of some sort, and Adidas slides. As sharp as he'd looked last night, I decided he looked sexier dressed down like this. He caught me looking at him and shot me the cutest smile.
"What are you thinking?" he said.
"Nothing," I said, smiling back at him, because I really wasn't thinking much of anything. I was too busy feeling things. All of them good. As we drove toward his side of town, he turned on the radio, then shuffled through his playlist, asking what I wanted to listen to. "Luke," I said, because it felt like our music, our songs. He nodded and then played "Drunk on You," singing along here and there. His voice kind of sucked, but for some reason, it only made me like him more. There was never much traffic in Nashville on Sundays, especially during church hours, so within a few more songs, we were pulling into Finch's driveway. His house was amazing, even bigger and more beautiful than Grace's or Beau's, which was saying a lot. I wasn't really surprised, as I already knew he was loaded, but I was still sort of blown away, and a little intimidated, too. We got out of his car and walked up to his front porch, where Finch unlocked the door and motioned for me to go in first. The alarm started to go off, and he turned and quickly punched a keypad, silencing it.
"So," he said, closing the door,
"what do you want to do?" I shrugged, looking around his extremely fancy foyer.
"Whatever you want."
"Where are your parents again?" I asked, even though he hadn't told me.
"My mom's in Bristol," Finch said, "her hometown."
"She's from Bristol?" I said, having imagined that she was from somewhere more chic like New York or California.
"Yeah, she grew up poor," he said, super matter-of-factly.
"Oh," I said, wondering what constituted poor in his mind, and whether I qualified. I told myself it didn't matter, and that I should stop overthinking things.
"And your dad? Where's he?"
"He's coming back from Texas today, but his flight doesn't land for a few hours."
"Oh, cool," I said, as Finch turned and led me down a hallway and into a gorgeous white kitchen.
"Can I get you a drink?"
At first I thought he meant alcohol, but then he clarified and said, "Tea, juice. I think we have orange and grapefruit. Water?" I said water would be good.
"Sparkling or still?" he said, a question I'd only ever heard posed at a really nice restaurant Nona had taken me to once.
Either. Still, I guess," I said, as I noticed the gigantic slab of marble on the kitchen island, veins running through it like the lines in one of my dad's oversized paper road atlases. Finch opened the door of an enormous stainless steel refrigerator and grabbed two bottles of Smart Water. He handed me one, then paused to unscrew his and take a sip. I did the same, and we swallowed in unison, then smiled at each other.
"Let's go to the basement," Finch said.
I said okay, suddenly picturing Caleb's unfinished basement,
with its concrete floors and cinder block walls, an odor of cat litter, mildew, and Clorox. I knew Finch's would be nothing like that, but as we went downstairs and he turned on the lights, I almost laughed out loud at the contrast. It was like a freaking hotel casino, with a fully stocked bar, a pool table, several old-school video games and pinball machines, and a huge leather sectional, along with a bunch of standalone recliners, all positioned around a mammoth TV that looked more like a movie screen. "Welcome to my man cave," he said. "Wow," I said, too impressed to play it cool. "This is incredible." He said thanks, flashing me a modest smile, then walked over to the sofa and sat down, patting the cushion next to him. I followed him and took a seat, leaving only a few inches between our legs. "You have a favorite movie?" he asked, grabbing one of three remotes from the coffee table in front of us. He flipped on the TV, then pulled up a menu of movies. "Not really," I said, my mind going blank because I wasn't thinking about movies. "Just pick something, anything," he said, scrolling too quickly for me to read the titles. I threw out Mean Girls because it was the first thing that popped into my head, and within a few seconds, we were watching the opening credits of a movie I'd virtually memorized. I'd seen it so many times. Finch put his feet up on the table, then grabbed another remote, hitting a button that turned off all the lights at once, transforming the room into a private theater. A beat later, he slid down a few inches, closing the gap between our legs. Then he took my hand, his entire forearm resting in my lap. It was so comfortable and natural, yet my heart still pounded in my chest, racing even harder as he caressed my thumb with his. For a long time, we stayed like that, my hand in his, watching and laughing. It felt intimate and amazing, but not sexual. And I began to wonder if maybe he wasn't going to kiss me after all. Then, in the middle of the four-way call scene, one of my favorites, he hit the pause button and said, "These bitches remind me of Polly and her friends." I started to laugh, but then glanced at his face and saw that his expression was stone serious, maybe even a little pissed. "Yeah," I said. "Me too." I waited for him to unpause the movie, but was glad when he didn't. Instead, he let go of my hand, then reached down for his bottle of water. As he took a sip, I knew what was coming, so I took a sip of mine too, preparing myself for his next move. It came smoothly, in the form of a quarter turn of his body toward mine, his arm extending behind me, draping along the back of the sofa. "Huh," he whispered, as I angled myself toward him too. "Hi," I said back, feeling completely lightheaded. He held my gaze for another few seconds, then closed his eyes, our faces coming together until it was finally happening. Finch was kissing me, and I was kissing him back. It sounds so cheesy to call it a dream come true, but that's what it was. Something I had imagined so many times alone as I was falling asleep in my bed. Only this was better, because he kept kissing me, more and more passionately until we were lying down beside each other, our faces illuminated only by the light of the frozen screen. I glanced over at it, and he took that as a hint to reach for the remote and turn it off altogether. He kissed me again, now in complete darkness, then rolled onto his back and pulled me on top of him, running his hands under my shirt from my shoulders down my back. They were big and strong, soft and warm. At first, I was too overwhelmed to react, but then I moved my hips in motion with his, sliding one hand down the back of his sweatpants, touching the top of his ass as far as I could reach. He had such a good body. We stayed in the PG-13 zone for several minutes before things escalated again, and he reached up under my bra, unfastening the front closure after a couple tries. He cupped my breasts with his palms and told me how perfect they were. The compliment made me feel bold, and I sat up and took my shirt all the way off, then rolled back on top of him, straddling him as he worked on the button fly of my jeans. It was taking too long, so I finished the job while he took off his own shirt, then sweats. Only his boxers and my red Victoria's Secret thong were between us. I was glad I'd worn it, just in case. Now on top of me, he reached down and touched me through the silk, whispering how good I felt, how wet I was. Then he slid his middle finger around the edges of my thong, dipping it inside me just a little bit. I arched my back, raising my hips up to his hand, both because it felt good and because it seemed like the sexy thing to do. And I desperately wanted to be sexy for him. I fleetingly thought of Polly, how much hotter she was than me. But I reminded myself that he wasn't this hard for her, or moaning her name right now. "I want you, Lila," he added. "I want you so bad." "I want you too," I said. "Have you before?" Finch whispered, kissing my ear, his breath giving me goosebumps everywhere. I hesitated, then tried to answer by reaching down and taking hold of him with my hand. My strategy seemed to work for a second, as he made a little groaning sound. But a second later, he seemed to remember his question. "So you're not a virgin?" he pressed. "No," I finally said, because I didn't want to lie, and because I thought he might stop if he thought I was a virgin. And I didn't want him to stop.
Chapter 19. Nina. I left Julie's and drove the 3 miles to my parents' house around supper time. I only called it supper when I was back in Bristol. Otherwise, it was dinner, no matter how casual or early. As I pulled into our cul-de-sac, then parked behind my dad's white Cadillac in the carport, I vowed to keep things light, both because I was too drained for more deep conversation and because I didn't want to prematurely worry them. But the second I walked into the house from the garage, my mom started firing questions at me. "Is everything okay?" she said before the door was even closed. "Everything's fine," I said. "Why the last-minute visit?" she asked, standing in the direct path of the kitchen. I took a deep breath and said, "Because I wanted to see you and Julie. I had a lovely afternoon with her." It probably wasn't the most accurate characterization of our day, but it wasn't a lie either. Clearly, Mom wasn't buying it, though, because she literally started wringing her hands, something I'd never seen anyone actually do. "What are Finch and Kirk doing today?" she asked, frowning. "Kirk's coming back from a business trip. He was in Dallas," I said, hearing that woman say, "honey," again. "And Finch?" Mom said. "He had to study. Exams coming up." I set my purse down on the small wooden pew that had been in the back hallway adjoining the laundry room, powder room, and kitchen for as long as I could remember. It was where my brother and I used to stow our book bags and rain boots and sporting equipment. I felt a pang of nostalgia, a feeling I associated with my mother, one of her defining traits. She was generally a happy person, but had a tendency to live in the past, making frequent references to, "when you kids were little." I played on that theme and said, "Can a girl visit her parents without an inquisition?" "A girl can," Mom said as I navigated my way around her, "but this one usually doesn't." It was a fair point. My trips back to Bristol had become few and far between in recent years, usually only for my parents' birthdays or a major holiday, and sometimes not even then. Occasionally, I'd squeeze a guilt-induced weekday into the mix, but our weekends were just too crammed with social plans. "Well, times are a-changin'," I said, thinking aloud. "Oh," Mom said, raising her eyebrows, her radar really going off now. "And why's that?" "Well, you know, with Finch going off to college," I said, wondering if it would still be Princeton. "I'll have more time." It was what I always said to my parents, what I always told myself as the months and years had flown by. As soon as we get out of this stage or that stage, out of middle school, Once Finch can drive. Once he gets into college. And yet somehow, life had only gotten busier. More complicated.
Hey, whatever works for you, Mom said. We're just glad to see you.
Yes, we're thrilled to see you, sweetie,
Dad said, walking into the kitchen from the front hallway, giving me a big hug. He was wearing one of his fishing shirts, even though he didn't fish, using all the assorted loops and pockets for reading glasses or writing instruments. Tonight, he was showcasing not one, but two mechanical pencils. You too, Dad, I said, as I inhaled his famous Sloppy Joes simmering on the stove. I spotted a fresh pack of Wonder hamburger buns, the primary colored dots on its package conjuring childhood, and next to it, a tinfoil-lined baking sheet covered with thawing frozen french fries. I noticed they were sweet potato, my mom's idea of gourmet. Dad opened a bottle of Merlot, sitting amid piles of unopened mail and other clutter. The wine was a new thing. They didn't really drink when I was growing up. But the clutter was a fixture. I honestly didn't know how they ever found anything.
Would you like a glass of wine? Dad said.
No, thanks, I said, pacing mindlessly over to the edge of the kitchen, looking into the family room, comforted by the sight of so many familiar knickknacks, along with stacks of magazines and newspapers and paperback books. Though their tastes differed, my parents were both big readers, and the presence of books in every room, to actually read rather than simply display, was one of the things I really missed about my childhood home.
So what's going on with you? I asked as cheerfully as I could, prompting Mom to launch into a detailed, long-winded update of all their neighbors and friends.
The Joneses just got back from a European riverboat cruise, 6 countries in 10 days. Mary Ellen had a hip replacement the same week John had a kidney stone. Imagine that bad luck.
The Middle Clay girl got engaged to her longtime boyfriend.
The Floyds had to put sassafras down.
Oh, and guess who I ran into at the grocery store this afternoon and might join us for dinner?
I mentally flagged her final run-on question as I glanced into the dining room and saw that the table was set for 4.
Oh, God, Mom, who did you invite to dinner? I said, my mind ticking through all the possibilities of people I did not want to see.
Oh, he's not coming for sure, she said, but...
Who, Mom?
Teddy,
she said with a little shrug.
As in my ex-boyfriend, I said, knowing there was no other Teddy in our world.
Yes, she said, that Teddy.
I stared at her, doing my best not to show my annoyance and offset all the goodwill I'd created by coming home.
And why exactly did you invite Teddy over?
I told you, I ran into him at Food City.
And?
I said. That just naturally segued into a dinner invitation?
More or less, she said, not seeming the slightest bit sheepish, which was the most ridiculous part.
At the very least, she could have pretended to be apologetic.
Can you explain that for me? I said, exchanging a glance with my dad.
Sure. So I saw him in the frozen vegetable aisle, Mom said, and I mentioned you were coming home. Then he said he hadn't seen you in years. I said he should stop by and say hello if he was free. He said he was, and that he might just do that.
That doesn't sound like a might, I said, gesturing toward the set table. That looks like a definite.
Well, I hope so, Mom said. For his sake, he's lonely, Nina.
He told you that? I asked, feeling very certain that he had not. Except for a pathetic type, which Teddy had never been, it wasn't the kind of thing a grown man would offer up to an ex-girlfriend's mother in the aisle of a grocery store.
Well, not specifically, but I could just tell he is, she said,
then went into further detail about how she had heard, through the grapevine, that Kara, his ex-wife, had remarried and moved to Charlotte with her new husband.
Apparently, he got some big job.
Teddy's broken-hearted. He misses the boy so much.
I had actually heard some of this through Julie, who had represented Teddy in a very straightforward divorce agreement, which included an amicable, flexible custody agreement and a clean division of minimal assets. Or, as the case might be,